the music that we opened with this evening, the mother entitled The Promise of the 24th. She recorded it on the 25th of April in 1954, I believe. This is the message that was released for the Darshan of the 24th of April, just a couple of days ago in Pondicherry by the Sri Aurobindo Ashram. Om. Here is a very powerful word, the Sanskrit word Om. It is used in India to express the divine immanence. There it is associated with every meditation, every contemplation, every yogic practice. More than any other sound, this sound, Om, gives rise to a feeling of peace, of serenity, of eternity. It has the true power of bringing one into contact with the divine essence it evokes, the Mother. So this evening, we come to the 18th chapter in the Life Divine, Mind and Supermind. And as always, Sri Aurobindo opens with citations or mottos taken from ancient Vedantic texts. And the first is familiar to us. It's taken from the Taittiriya Upanishad. And it says, he discovered that mind was the Brahman. You may remember this is part of the story of the father and son, Varanu and Bhrigu. The son approaches the boy for knowledge. The son approaches the father for knowledge. And the father sends him off to inquire into what is the nature of Brahman. And he discovers several steps of a great ladder of being that lead to a supreme bliss, which is finally the source of all manifestation. But along the way, he discovers that mind is one of these steps, one of these formations of this divine truth. So he knew, he discovered, he experienced that mind was the Brahman. And then the next is from the Bhagavad Gita. Indivisible, but as if divided in beings. Avibhaktam cha bhuteshu vibhaktam. So always one, but to the appearance of things, divided in this one and in that one, but never sacrificing its single reality. This is the nature of the supreme mystery of being, which it is Sri Aurobindo's business to elucidate in these philosophic pages in the Arya. Remember, The Life Divine was one essay that appeared in the Arya, and he approached the nature of existence from a yogic perspective. He looked at it in terms of poetry. He had a wide embrace of all the fields of human knowledge that were presented in this organ of the Arya. But here he is trying to state in terms which are accessible to the rational mind in terms of philosophy, what this reality looks like. So it is a mental picture that he presents here. And as you know, he begins with the idea that there is an omnipresent reality, which is the backdrop of all that he's teasing out here as we go along. There's an omnipresent reality which presents itself as Satchidananda to our mind. And that infinite triunity of being, existence, consciousness, and bliss, condenses itself creatively into a supramental consciousness, which then distributes the oneness of Satchidananda into a many-sided reality, a harmonic cosmos in which the one and the many perfectly reflect the reality of each. Mutuality, harmony, essentiality are all present in that. So how do we get from that to here, to our experience? He has to be able to reconcile and to integrate that supreme reality and our experience here, or all is lost. So, let's begin. The conception which we have so far been striving to form is that of the essence only of the supramental life, which the divine soul possesses securely in the being of Satchidananda, but which the human soul has to manifest in this body of Satchidananda formed here into the mold of a mental and physical living. So the divine soul is called the Jivatman, which is in its native poise in the supramental consciousness, a part of the expression of Satchidananda. Here, Satchidananda is experienced by the human soul. And if Satchidananda is here, and Satchidananda is above, then one is part of the other, and the human soul is akin to the divine soul. This supramental consciousness, as the Jivatman, by suggestion, is associated somehow with our nature here as we struggle in a seemingly divided world. So to continue, but so far as we have been able yet to envisage this supramental existence, it does not seem to have any connection or correspondence with life as we know it, life active between the two terms of our normal existence, the two firmaments of mind and body. It seems rather to be a state of being, a state of consciousness, a state of active relation and mutual enjoyment, such as disembodied souls might possess and experience in a world without physical forms, a world in which differentiation of souls had been accomplished, but not differentiation of bodies, a world of active and joyous infinities, not of form-imprisoned spirits. Therefore, it might reasonably be doubted whether such a divine living would be possible with this limitation of bodily form and this limitation of form-imprisoned mind and form-trammeled force, which is what we now know as existence. So he must be able to bridge this gap between that above and this here. And if the description of the life and existence of the divine soul is wonderful, it still seems fluid. It still seems as if it would be without definition. We live here, apparently within forms, divided but fixed. From our common experience, can we gain access back to that? If we cannot, then there would be a reason to doubt whether a divine life here were possible. By the way, the word trammel, where he says form trammeled, a trammel is a kind of a net. You catch either fish or birds with it. It's got three layers. Inside is a fine meshed layer, and the object which you're trying to capture enters in and reaches into this fine meshed layer, and then it's formed through its own force of compulsion into a kind of pocket and is there caught. So an untrammeled life, an untrammeled existence, or an untrammeled force would mean something that has been freed, that was previously captive, but has been returned to its natural state. So I think we can go on now to the second paragraph. In fact, we have striven to arrive at some conception of that supreme infinite being, conscious force, and self-delight, of which our world is a creation and our mentality a perverse figure. We have tried to give ourselves an idea of what this divine Maya may be, this truth consciousness, this real idea, by which the conscious force of the transcendent and universal existence conceives, forms, and governs the universe, the order, the cosmos of its manifested delight of being. So we have, as he states, a supreme infinite being, conscious force and self-delight, Satchit-Ananda. Our world is a derivation of this divine reality. And as he states it here, the notion is that it is the divine Maya which distributes this oneness into a many-sided manifestation. This divine Maya he equates with a truth consciousness and with a real idea. So the divine Maya is that which measures out the illimitable. The truth consciousness is always capable of its own essential nature, its own placement in Satchit-Ananda as it expresses itself multiply. And the real idea, whatever it conceives, has substance, has breadth, has expansion, is there. And so, the conscious force, which is transcendent, is also universal. Transcendent, above all manifestation, universal, forming a cosmos which is based upon reality, and all of this manifesting the essential ananda, which is itself experience. It seems to be Sri Aurobindo's suggestion here, is it not, when he says, by which the conscious force of the transcendent conceives, forms, and governs, that out of Satchit-Ananda, it is conscious force which brings into operation the supramental reality. The conscious force, again, is interesting to us because it registers with Sri Aurobindo's book, The Mother, where the consciousness force is typified as this supreme Mahashakti, who establishes the worlds in their ordering. So he says, but we have not studied the connections of these four great and divine terms with the three others with which our human experience is alone familiar, mind, life, and body. So there are the divine four, Satchit-Ananda, and then the supramental, expressing Satchit-Ananda. These are the divine realms. What is available and close to our human experience is mind, life, and body. He says, we have not scrutinized this other and apparently undivine Maya, which is the root of all our striving and suffering, or seen how precisely it develops out of the divine reality or the divine Maya. Until we have done this, till we have woven the missing cords of connection, our world is still unexplained to us, and the doubt of a possible unification between that higher existence and this lower life has still a basis. So this is the second time he said this. This is a real concern to him. It is crucial to Sri Aurobindo to be able to demonstrate the connection of the higher and the lower. We know, he writes, that our world has come forth from Satchit Ananda and subsists in his being. We conceive that he dwells in it as the enjoyer and knower, Lord and Self. We have seen that our dual terms of sensation, mind, force, being, can only be representations of his delight, his conscious force, his divine existence. So, to back up for a moment, Satchit Ananda again emerges in theistic Vedanta, in the Muktika, Upanishad, and others, rather late. Maybe this is a concept which is 1,000 years old or so, but definitely is not part of the impersonal approach to reality, which Shankara in Advaita Vedanta espouses. It is theistic. So all of this world has come forward and subsists in his being. Satchitananda is a person. It is inconceivable that anything could exist outside that being, because it is the only existence. It is the sole, S-O-L-E, existence. So he says, we can conceive that he dwells in it as the enjoyer. So again, back to the basis of delight. All of this is the manifestation for the delight of the Supreme and the knower. So as he projects forward this delightful creation, he knows it for what it is. It rests and resides in his own being, and he knows it through identity. He is the Lord. This is not some existence which gains freedom from his control. Since it's within his own being, he is master of it, utterly, completely. So the universe is not a chaotic representation, a disorganized or disordered conception. It is real. It is nascent. It is conscious of its own greatness. And he is also the self of it all. So he is the fundamental subjective consciousness containing and witnessing it all. We have seen, Sri Aurobindo writes, that our dual terms of sensation, mind, force, being, can only be representations of his delight, his conscious force, his divine existence. So each of these is a different value, as if divided, as the Gita says, but really part of that indivisible one. But it would seem that they are actually so much the opposite of what he really and supernally is, that we cannot, while dwelling in the cause of these opposites, cannot, while contained in the lower triple term of existence, attain to the divine living. That is so high, and we are so base, that how in the world could we bridge that distance? We must either exalt this lower being into that higher status, or exchange body for that pure existence, life for that pure condition of conscious force, sensation, and mentality, for that pure delight and knowledge which live in the truth of the spiritual reality. So we can't be both at once, would seem to be the mind's reply to this idea. So we would have to either exalt this into that, and that sublation would erase the lower manifestation, mind, life, and body would disappear into that, or we would have to abandon it and simply place our consciousness into that supreme existence again, and that also blanks it out. So this is not his position, but he would say this is what would appeal to the mind. This goes back, does it not, to the third chapter of The Life Divine, you know, the refusal of the ascetic, where spiritual seclusion of spirit and spirit seems to be the only answer in escaping the enigmatic nature of the universe. It is not Sri Aurobindo's position. And to continue, must not this mean that we abandon all earthly or limited mental existence for something which is its opposite, either for some pure state of the spirit, or else for some world of the truth of things, if such exists, or other worlds, if such exist, of divine bliss, divine energy, divine being? In that case, the perfection of humanity is elsewhere than in humanity itself. The summit of its earthly evolution can only be a fine apex of dissolving mentality, whence it takes the great leap either into formless being or into worlds beyond the reach of embodied mind. By the way, he's changed a word here. Either for some pure state of the Atman is what he wrote in the Arya, and he's changed Atman to spirit here, so it has more universal application. So this would mean the failure of the cosmic promise to reveal Satchidananda in time, in space, in particularity. And he continues, but in reality, all that we call undivine can only be an action of the four divine principles themselves, such action of them as was necessary to create this universe of forms. Those forms have been created not outside, but in the divine existence, conscious force, and bliss. Not outside, but in and as a part of the working of the divine real idea. What he's just said is that mind, life, and body, the idea of their functions, are seated in the supermind. They are part of the real idea. They exist already at the supramental level ere they wind up as manifested realities here in this seemingly divided cosmos apprehendable to our experience. So he continues, there is therefore no reason to suppose that there cannot be any real play of the higher divine consciousness in a world of forms, or that forms and their immediate supports, mental consciousness, energy of vital force, and formal substance must necessarily distort that which they represent. It is possible, even probable, that mind, body, and life are to be found in their pure forms in the divine truth itself, are there in fact as subordinate activities of its consciousness and part of the complete instrumentation by which the Supreme Force always works. So these are unified functionaries of the supramental activity. Mind, life, and body must then be capable of divinity. Well, it would be the force of logic, wouldn't it? If they arise from that, then even if we experience them here, seemingly separated, since all is in reality placed permanently in Satchidananda, that they would be able to restore themselves to their original functionality. Their form and working in that short period out of possibly only one cycle of the terrestrial evolution which science reveals to us need not represent all the potential workings of these three principles in the living body. So body, life, and mind, as we see them now, are partially developed in the supramental. Obviously, they're fulsome, regnant. Here, they are beginning their activities in these early stages of the cosmos. See this drama, this lila of the universe, as a play of many acts, and we're still in the opening pages of the drama. Much more is to be revealed, and we should not convict body, life, or mind of incapacity based only on what we've seen so far. They work as they do because they are by some means separated in consciousness from the divine truth from which they proceed. Were this separation once abrogated by the expanding energy of the divine in humanity, their present functioning might well be converted, would indeed naturally be converted by a supreme evolution and progression into that purer working which they have in the truth consciousness. So the emergence of this divine power in evolving humanity restores them to their own full nature. So our job is to continue to grow and to ennoble and restore them. By the way, the idea of abrogated, the definition of abrogate is to annul, to rescind. So there seems to have been perhaps an original agreement. We annul the agreement so that the separation must disappear. Whatever plausibility, whatever temporary purpose it had, cannot stand in the way of an evolving universe of which humanity is the current spear point going forward. Separation must go. Division must go. So then our next paragraph, in that case, not only would it be possible to manifest and maintain the divine consciousness in the human mind and body, but even that divine consciousness might in the end, increasing its conquests, remold mind, life, and body themselves into a more perfect image of its eternal truth, and realize not only in soul but in substance its kingdom of heaven upon earth. The first of these victories, the internal, has certainly been achieved in a greater or less degree by some, perhaps by many upon earth. The other, the external, even if never more or less realized in past eons as a first type for future cycles, and still held in the subconscious memory of the earth nature, may yet be intended as a coming victorious achievement of God in humanity. So manifesting supermind will solidify the human hold and extend its reign. The Vedic age may have given us a glimpse of what this perfected humanity might be like, but even if it failed to fully figure it or to capture its essence, we have a memory of what it might be as a projection into the future to beckon us forwards. So he continues to conclude this paragraph. This earthly life need not be necessarily and forever a wheel of half-joyous, half-anguished effort. Attainment may also be intended with the glory and joy of God made manifest upon earth. This is his idea, of course, that it is part of the intention of the cosmic manifestation that there be a revelation of all the secreted powers resonant in us, invested in us by Satchitananda through the creative activity of the supramental manifestation. that, in other words, all the seeds of glory which have been embedded in the universe should come to flower. He is not saying that all of creation must reflect that, but some part of the cosmos, it is suggested, should manifest that and secure the victory. And if some part of it does, then the whole cosmic enterprise is a winner. So then, what mind, life, and body are in their supreme sources, and what, therefore, they must be in the integral completeness of the divine manifestation, when informed by the truth and not cut off from it by the separation and the ignorance in which presently we live, this then is the problem that we have next to consider. So what are they, really? In their essence, what are we? So the next several essays, Sri Aurobindo will be addressing these questions. But he's going to be looking at them in their pure form and not just as they are cut off through the separation and the ignorance. Separation, that which separates us from the immense reality of Satchitananda and the ordered harmony of the supramental. Ignorance, from the term ignore, to take our awareness away from. So what is it in mind, life, and body which ignores that reality? Why would it ignore it? Why would it forget that placement? For there they must have already their perfection towards which we here are growing. He's referring to their placement in the supramental consciousness. In that realm of the real idea, mind, life, and body pre-exist. They are there and know precisely what they're to do. And action, and their action is a complete mutual harmony. We, who are only the first shackled movement of the mind, which is evolving in matter, we who are not yet liberated from the conditions and effects of that involution of spirit in form, that plunge of light into its own shadow, by which the darkened material consciousness of physical nature was created. The type of all perfection towards which we grow, the terms of our highest evolution must already be held in the divine real idea. They must be there formed and conscious for us to grow towards and into them. For that pre-existence in the divine knowledge is what our human mentality names and seeks as the ideal. The ideal is an eternal reality which we have not yet realized in the conditions of our own being, not a non-existent, which the eternal and divine has not yet grasped, and only we imperfect beings have glimpsed and mean to create. So their perfect roles are pre-existent and stand above. We need only to discover and implement. That perfection which pre-exists is also that which indeed creates. And that ideal is a reality. Remember, it is a real idea. It is not some pie in the sky. It is not insubstantial. It has real substance and is invested here. And so, what conditions we have here, which have not realized them, means that we are open to further progress and development so that we can attain what they are. As we grow, then we know, and they are restored to their own originations. No wonder that we are ever restless and impatient as a species as we grow upwards. We become avid of that goal, And we accept less and less well imperfection, less and less well rootedness in ignorance. We aspire more and more. The idea that that perfection pre-exists is a reversal of Teilhard de Chardin's position, by the way, who in effect believes that divinity is something that emerges in the passage of time through the process of development. For Sri Aurobindo, it's a recovery. It's a circle being completed. Next paragraph, in which he now begins to define mind and what its area of expertise is. Mind first, the chained and hampered sovereign of our human living. A rather ironic assessment. Mind, in its essence, is a consciousness which measures, limits, cuts out forms of things from the indivisible whole and contains them as if each were a separate integer. Well, the divine Maya measures out also, but invests the infinite in the finite so that the finite can always reveal the infinite. The mind limits and cuts out as if to form a separate integer, even with what exists only as obvious parts and fractions. Mind establishes this fiction of its ordinary commerce, that they are things with which it can deal separately and not merely as aspects of a whole. For even when it knows that they are not things in themselves, it is obliged to deal with them as if they were things in themselves. Otherwise, it could not subject them to its own characteristic activity. So it reaches out to grasp, and it grasps one thing. If it reaches out and grasps many things and begins to construct a whole, but he's never, this mind, able to grasp all things at once. It is restricted to partiality. It is this essential characteristic of mind, which conditions the workings of all its operative powers, whether conception, perception, sensation, or the dealings of creative thought. It conceives, perceives, senses things as if rigidly cut out from a background or a mass, and employs them as fixed units of the material given to it for creation or possession. All its action and enjoyment deal thus with wholes that form part of a greater whole, and these subordinate wholes, again, are broken up into parts which are also treated as wholes for the particular purposes they serve. So this is a restricted construction. It is trying to build wholes, but they are always restricted and limited in scope. They are never representations of the infinite. Mind, he says, may divide, multiply, add, subtract, but it cannot get beyond the limits of this mathematics. If it goes beyond and tries to conceive a real whole, it loses itself in a foreign element. It falls from its own firm ground into the ocean of the intangible, into the abysms of the infinite, where it can neither perceive, conceive, sense, nor deal with its subject for creation and enjoyment. So, entering the infinite, the mind blanks out. It can neither perceive, that is, look outside itself and apprehend the object that it desires. Conceive, it cannot create or represent a greater reality in a symbolic name and form, namarupa. It cannot sense nor deal with its subject for creation and enjoyment. So it has no means of interfacing with it. So in terms of its essential consciousness, it has no way to do it. It cannot, in a sense, formally experience, nor can it conceive of a greater reality. So the mind here, in that experience, is useless. For if mind appears sometimes to conceive, to perceive, to sense, or to enjoy with possession the infinite, it is only in seeming and always in a figure of the infinite. So we make a model, and we say, this is what the infinite looks like, and I can deal with it as a model. I can play with it, and it's a simulacrum. It's never the real thing. What it does thus vaguely possess is simply a formless vast and not the real spaceless infinite. The moment it tries to deal with that, to possess it, at once the inalienable tendency to delimitation comes in, and the mind finds itself again handling images, forms, and words. Mind cannot possess the infinite. It can only suffer it or be possessed by it. It can only lie blissfully helpless under the luminous shadow of the real cast down on it from planes of existence beyond its reach. The possession of the infinite cannot come except by an ascent to those supramental planes, nor the knowledge of it except by an inert submission of mind to the descending messages of the truth-conscious reality. And these sentences remind us of another place in the Taittiriya Upanishad where it says, words turn back with the mind, not attaining. That would be 2.4 in Taittiriya Upanishad. And also, the subtlety beyond our knowledge, which is in the Gita, again, 13.16. In other words, verses which are very close to the ones that Sri Aurobindo cited are also apposite of what he is writing here. So the mind reaches up but cannot possess the infinite, deals with it only through a simulacrum, and cannot come into the possession of it unless it ascends into the supramental consciousness, or that descends with its truth-conscious reality into us here. So, to this point in the chapter, he has said that he has to reconcile Satchit Ananda with the creative connection with mind, life, and body. And if he's not able to do that, then our goal of perfection here in an evolving humanity fails. But he doesn't think it has to fail because mind, life, and matter pre-exist in supermind, so that they must be perfectible here too. They can realize their own essence here if we remove whatever force of separation divides them from their originating source. So we have to grasp, what is this thing that separates? What is this that divides? And so he's going to approach them thematically, first with the mind, which he has done in this last paragraph, and the rest of the chapter. We'll deal with it more explicitly. And then in subsequent chapters, we'll be dealing with life and matter. So if you remember the scale of things, Sat, Chit, Ananda, supramental, mind, life, matter. These are going to be the seven worlds, the four divine, Satchit Ananda and the supermind, and then the three, which are part of our terrestrial formation, mind, life, and matter. So he's going through them one at a time. Now, this is a rather long chapter. It's roughly 15 pages in length. And we have been working roughly about 5 pages per night. So I think you can expect that it's going to take 3 weeks to get through all of this. So bear with us. This is the first stage. We're through about 5 pages tonight. And I think this is where we'll put our bookmarks for this evening. And our next sentence will begin, this essential faculty and the essential limitation that accompanies it are the truth of mind and fix its real nature and action. Swabhava and Swadharma. So that will be next time. I thought a passage from Savitri again might be apposite of our study. This is in the 11th book, the Book of Everlasting Day. Ascending out of the limiting breadths of mind, they shall discover the world's huge design and step into the truth, the right, the vast. You shall reveal to them the hidden eternities, the breadth of infinitudes not yet revealed, some rapture of the bliss that made the world, some rush of the force of God's omnipotence, some beam of the omniscient mystery. But when the hour of the divine draws near, the mighty mother shall take birth in time, and God be born into the human clay, in forms made ready by your human lives. Then shall the truth supreme be given to men. There is a being beyond the being of mind, an immeasurable cast into many forms, a miracle of the multitudinous one. There is a consciousness mind cannot touch, its speech cannot utter, nor its thought reveal. It has no home on earth, no center in man, yet is the source of all things thought and done, the fount of the creation and its works. It is the origin of all truth here, the sun orb of mind's fragmentary rays, infinity's heaven that spills the rain of God, the immense that calls to man to expand the spirit, the wide aim that justifies his narrow attempts, a channel for the little he tastes of bliss. Namaste, Jai Ma.